Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, Henry Shookman will be here. He is the author of a new novel called The Lost City. Right now, I would like to welcome Kenny Ausubel and John Fogarty. Kenny is the co-founder and co-executive director of Bioneers, and John Fogarty is a physician of family medicine and public health, and he serves on the board of the Physicians for Social Responsibility and chairs the Global Warming Committee and is also the director of the New Energy Economy. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you both. Let's talk about the One Sky campaign, which is something that, you all are active in. John.
Great. Well, One Sky is a national movement dedicated to creating the political power necessary to bring about federal legislation on climate by 2010. And that legislation would be aimed at creating green jobs in America, necessary to create the workforce to solve climate change, as well as doing what's scientifically necessary to bring down our emissions in our country to safe levels so that we are protecting future generations from dangerous climate change.
Now, you actually ceased your family, your medical practice 5 years ago to work on climate change. What motivated you to do that at the time?
I did. You know, I was living out on the Navajo Reservation working in a community called Crown Point, where there was a proposal to create a uranium mine in the only source of drinking water for about 15,000 Navajo people. And I was tired of hearing businesses and even the government saying that the only development possible for that community was uranium, which would be catastrophic for the community. And I said, we need to create a new direction for energy in our country. And I heard that from communities all over Navajo Reservation. I heard that from the Northwest area in near Farmington, where they're proposing to build a third coal-fired power plant. And I said, we can do better than that as a country. And I also looked at climate change and realized that unless we create a new direction for energy in our country, our children are going to be living in an entirely different world. And I was tired of hearing excuses again from our government saying we can only do with fossil fuels, we can only use oil and gas and coal. And I felt very strongly that we could create a new energy economy and a new direction for energy in our country.
How have you seen the political climate shift in the 5 years that you've been doing this?
You know, it's really been astounding. There's been a paradigm shift in, I think, public consciousness, where people are recognizing that things are changing. They're seeing the changes in our climate in their everyday lives. They're seeing the changes around the world. You know, for example, the Arctic, just in the last 2 years, melted by 25% just in 2 years. And that's going far beyond what the scientists predicted. Even just going back to 2004, they didn't think that the Arctic was going to be melted by the end of the century. And we saw a 25% melt in just the last 2 years. And some scientists are saying that the Arctic may be gone in the next 7 years. So I think people are seeing the changes, and there's a shift in public consciousness, which is creating the political will necessary to bring about bold climate legislation. And that's what One Sky is dedicated to doing, is to aggregating the power that's out there. There's a lot of energy bubbling up, but what we want to do is focus that power and create the kind of megaphone toward Congress and say, this is what's scientifically necessary to solve climate change.
So there are multiple ways that you go about doing that. What are those ways?
We're working in a number of states all around the country right now. We're working with young people. One Sky partnered with the Energy Action Coalition, which was a group of more than 40 student organizations around the country, to bring 6,000 college students to Washington in November. It was the largest lobbying effort on climate change in the history of the United States. This week and last week, we've been having meetings with congressional representatives around the country, and we're in all 50 states. We've had 500 meetings with congressional representatives from around the country. So we're really aggregating the power that's already out there. I think people are concerned. They want to get involved. They want to do something on climate change. And what we intend to do is to create the on-ramps to the movement and create the political will.
What do you hear when you talk to members of Congress? What are they saying back to you?
Well, I think that we're hearing from some, like Tom Udall, that now is the time. We have to do something. We've got to come together and solve this problem. And, you know, Tom, for example, introduced the renewable energy standard, calling for 15% of our electricity coming from renewables last session. And they're really out there as champions. And then you're hearing from others that are still chanting the same old rhetoric that we can't do anything, it'll hurt our economy. And that's just plain false. We know that the solutions to climate change are going to build our economy, create jobs.
Well, and also the failing to look at climate change, but doing nothing will hurt the economy, you know, as coastal cities get washed away and whatnot.
Absolutely, absolutely. There was a good study from the United Kingdom, from the best scientists in the United Kingdom, which showed that doing nothing would cost our world economy by about 10% of the world's gross domestic product. If we do something, it may cost as little as 1%. And that's an investment which creates jobs locally. You know, if you want to retrofit a house, make a house more efficient, you can't ship it over to China to put in new windows. You can't ship it to Indonesia to put in insulation. You keep the jobs here. And we believe that's an incredible opportunity for young people, for future generations. We're going to be running a green jobs initiative in Albuquerque to create a green jobs training program to train young people in the jobs of the future. So we're looking at training young people in solar energy, in efficiency technologies, weatherization, so that as we begin to create solutions to climate change, people are going to be able to plug in and benefit from it, create opportunities.
Do those things, do green jobs actually create a significant economic base, or could they?
Absolutely. There was a study that just came out from Yale, a group of scientists. They looked at studies from all around the country and found that indeed the green jobs moving to a new energy economy would boost our economy. It would really create the kind of stimulus that would re-energize our economy. You know, we're in a huge slump right now, and the solutions to climate change offer a huge opportunity. And you can go to www.onesky.org, and there's a link to those studies that were done at Yale. And it's pretty convincing that we can create jobs, millions of new jobs in America, which would create a huge stimulus for our economy.
Is Europe already doing that?
Europe has started to do it, and they've taken the lead over the United States. The United States used to be the leader in solar energy and in wind energy, even up until the early 1990s. But because of really inadequate policies at the federal level, Japan now produces more than 50% of the solar panels. Denmark produces 50% of the wind turbines. Germany has an initiative to get 30% of their power from solar energy and wind energy. So we're really falling behind as a country. And we believe that if we can pass some strong, bold legislation on climate policy, we will be able to create that kind of stimulus necessary to re-energize our economy.
In terms of the retrofitting houses and buildings and so on, where is the greatest gain to be made? Is it in the commercial sector, for example, putting solar panels on Walmart or whatever, versus the people's homes and houses?
Well, there's a huge initiative that actually started here in Santa Fe by architect Ed Mazzaria, who designed the Chavez Center and has designed a lot of the really cutting-edge green buildings in New Mexico. And Ed started an initiative called the Architecture 2030 Initiative, which calls for all new buildings starting now to be 50% more energy efficient, and by 2030 to be carbon neutral, to not produce any more emissions. And that has been a phenomenal success. Local governments around the country are recognizing this as a huge win in terms of solving climate change, but also at saving money. So California, for example, the state of California just adopted the 2030 challenge for all residential buildings by 2020. They actually went beyond the challenge. They said by 2020, all new buildings will be carbon
neutral.
New
buildings.
Yeah, and by 2030, they will all commercial buildings will have to be carbon neutral. So that's going to transform the building sector in America.
There's a problem that I think a lot of people face who, for example, in the city of Santa Fe, who would like to do something besides buy fluorescent light bulbs and, you know, insulate their windows better. They'd like to use solar technology or whatever in their houses, and it's just too expensive. Do you see either the price coming down or governments getting involved with actually subsidizing this?
Well, I think that there's a lot that the government can do to help lead. This last legislative session, we actually worked on passing a bill that would require utilities to invest in efficiency rather than just selling natural gas, so that they actually have to put a percentage of their revenues into helping homeowners do better insulation, do better windows, install low-flow showers, which save energy. So there's a lot of
what's in it for them? I mean, they then sell fewer units of energy.
Exactly. And there's actually, if they meet targets and they're able to actually do it, there will be an ability for them to recoup some of that lost in terms of
from us.
Yeah, there was kind of a trade-off there.
Yeah. We're talking to John Fogarty about the One Sky campaign. Kenny Ausubel is sitting with us as well. What's happening in New Mexico? You're involved with a program called Dreaming New Mexico.
Yeah, we decided to see if there were a way that Bioneers, since we're based out of New Mexico, could do something locally here. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that as people seeking social change, so often we're just caught up in emotive resistance, stopping all the bad stuff from happening. And we seldom really step back to ask what it is we really want, what our dream is. So that's why we called the project Dreaming New Mexico. The idea to be to envision a positive future and then, in a sense, start to map how we could get from here to there, you know, given current reality and what the steps would be.
It sounds sort of like Carlos Castaneda or something.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment.
No, I'm just kidding.
Green shamanism. And so we hooked up with a number of top local groups, including John and the coalition here, and Eli Lee, the Center for Civic Policy, which works on a lot of good policy and legislation, Pam Roy and Farm to Table, and some really wonderful folks working in New Mexico. And we started principally with two issues. You know, the idea behind Bioneers is that it's all connected. The web of life is intricately interconnected and interdependent, but so too are all the social issues. And in a sense, you can only solve the whole problem. You can't solve issues in isolation because they're all contingent on each other. So, but you have to start somewhere. So we picked energy and food systems as the first two. And I have a wonderful colleague on the project, Peter Warshall, who's a longtime field biologist and anthropologist and self-described infrastructure freak. He's a former editor of Whole Earth magazine catalog. And
that's very super geeky. Infrastructure freak.
Well, we need him. I'm glad he's there.
I know. It's fabulous.
People who love infrastructure.
Yeah.
So what Peter did, we were sitting actually around the table with John here about a year ago having a cup of tea, and Peter threw out this idea of what about if we do a future map of energy in New Mexico, the age of renewable energy. The year is 2020. We've done everything right. What would it look like? So we're in the thick of that. The map will actually be produced by June, and it'll be available to everybody, you know, the public, as well as hopefully people in positions of influence will pay some attention. And it really shows the map of what we need, where we could be.
So what does that map look like?
Well, it's a physical map that you can put on the wall of New Mexico. It'll show, it has all kinds of different icons and symbols. It'll show where transmission lines need to be, where the wind hotspots in the state are, for example, where we could do concentrated solar energy. Where we can do biofuel where that makes sense, and geothermal. New Mexico is very rich in geothermal energy. But, you know, what was very interesting, Mary Charlotte, in the research was that the real struggle comes down to a very symbolic one, which is that really what the big dogs want, and they don't care, in a sense, what kind of energy goes through the transmission lines, they want a centralized grid that's not accessible, right? What an inherently resilient and appropriate energy system would look like is a decentralized system, what's called distributed energy, where from your home, for example, if you're collecting excess solar energy, you can feed it back to the grid and actually get paid for that.
Well, some people do that already.
Exactly. But if these new transmission lines are built in a highly centralized fashion, nobody's going to be able to have access to them and to get to them. So that's actually the crux of the political struggle, is a decentralized system versus a centralized one.
So what is the centralization and decentralization? Power lines have to go everywhere because they have to distribute power to wherever power is needed. So are you talking about the sources of the power, namely the power plants, being decentralized?
Well, it's complex because it'll work on different levels in a sense, but part of what you have is the giant transmission lines dump into local substations, and then those distribute. That's where they step down the voltage, and then it comes to your house. So for one thing, those could be feeding back to the grid if you have a more decentralized system. But within that as well, for example, quite a few companies now, particularly financial services companies, credit card, phone, service centers, want their own power systems because they don't want to rely on the grid. They know how brittle it is and how vulnerable it is. So they actually are setting up, in effect, their own power systems. So communities, Santa Fe could be relatively self-reliant if we decided to go that direction. One of the things that we're showing on the map is the wind energy from the eastern plains of New Mexico, with just the putting in one transmission line, would be able to take a huge proportion of Santa Fe and Albuquerque off coal soon. In the foreseeable next several years. Right now we live in these beautiful hip places and we think we're doing everything right, and actually we're sucking coal. So that's the true story behind it all.
So what do you envision in terms of not having any fossil fuels working at all? You don't have gas, you don't have coal. Where is the energy coming? Is it from? Is it coming from decentralized, wind is one thing, but then decentralized solar panels on everybody's house or a centralized solar plant?
Do you want to respond to that, John?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. The first is efficiency. If we want to solve climate change, we absolutely have to increase the efficiency of our buildings. Half of the global warming emissions come from the building sector. So just by using the right design, we can dramatically reduce our emissions. And by implementing existing technologies for building design, it gives us some time to start developing the new energy technologies. I think it's going to be a combination of things, but solar energy is really going to be what powers our world, and there really isn't another source that is going to be able to provide the kind of scope of energy necessary to power humanity. And distributed solar really makes the most sense.
I think a lot of people don't really understand that. They think of sunshine being a sort of, soft, quote-unquote, soft power source, and things like nuclear and coal and so on being hard power sources.
Right,
they're sort of framed that way by the metaphor makers.
Yeah, the solar, people don't understand the how much solar is out there. Ed Mazzaria, again, did a study looking at how much solar energy falls on a home in Seattle, of all places,
and to meet its
energy
needs. A
cloudy place. And more than three times the energy requirement for the home falls on just the south side and the roof of a home in Seattle. In New Mexico, it's more like 10 times. So we just need to...
Can that actually be harvested? Are there panels or whatever efficient enough to harvest that solar energy?
That's the trick. I think when we as a society come together and say, look, we're going to solve climate change, we're going to create a new direction for energy in our country, and we make the necessary investment to harness that energy, it'll happen. And I think it'll happen very quickly.
Now, Bill McKibben is going to be speaking. He's the author of a lot of books, including Fight Global Warming Now, The End of Nature, Deep Economy. And he's going to be speaking actually tomorrow in Albuquerque from 7 to 8 at the Student Union Ballroom at the University of New Mexico, and then there's going to be a training beforehand from 5 to 6:30. What's the nature of this training?
Well, OneSky is working to bring together people who are concerned about the issue of climate change, who care about it, who care about our energy system and want to get involved, again, creating the on-ramps to the movement. And we're really trying to bring it, we're bringing together hundreds of people who want to get involved in climate change, want to make a difference, to figure out how we can be better with our communications, how we can be better organized, have a better network, to create the, again, that megaphone on Congress saying, this is what is scientifically necessary to solve climate change and to create a new energy economy. So we're hoping that we can get as many people out there to join us tomorrow at 5 o'clock at the Sub Ballroom. And it's a free training. We invite anyone from Santa Fe, Albuquerque to come on down and join us.
Now, as we know, there's a political situation in this country, which is that big oil is very much subsidized by our tax dollars. Do you envision that going away and things like solar and wind technologies starting to get some of that benefit?
Absolutely. That's one of the things we're going to be pushing for in Congress is redirecting the tax incentives, redirecting the subsidies. Right now, more than $15 billion a year goes to the fossil fuel industry, yet at a time when they are making record profits, where ExxonMobil is literally making hundreds of billions of dollars, they're still getting subsidies, taxpayer subsidies.
So and our increased gas prices at the tank.
Exactly. We're paying for it coming and going.
Why is there not a rebellion in the streets?
Well, there should be, but Congress is controlled by big oil, big energy. Heather Wilson, for example, voted against the repeal of those subsidies. There was a big initiative to repeal those subsidies, to redirect those subsidies toward renewables, toward solar, toward wind, toward efficiency. And, you know, we still have Congress controlled by big oil, big energy. And until we create the kind of political will necessary to put pressure on Congress, I think big oil is going to have their day.
Another subsidized sector is nuclear, and there are people like presidential candidate John McCain saying that nuclear power is a solution to the global warming problem. Your comments?
Nuclear power is absolutely not a solution to global warming.
Why not?
If you look at the needs for humanity, energy needs, if we wanted to meet just 20% of our energy needs by mid-century, we would have to build 3 nuclear power plants a week for the next 42 years. And that's just 20% of our energy needs. If you created that much nuclear power, you'd run out of uranium, so you'd have to rely on what are called breeder reactors, which create plutonium. So essentially, you'd be creating little repositories of nuclear weapons materials all over the entire world. You know, we can't even control the nuclear fuel that's out there right now. There's no way that we would be able to control it if we were spreading plutonium around the world.
Well, not only that, but each of those plants don't they cost $2 or $3 billion each?
Right. The cost is definitely prohibitive right now. But I think that the bigger issue is how do we meet our energy needs? Again, if you built 3 nuclear power plants a week for the next 42 years, you still would only be meeting 20% of our energy needs. So where are we going to get the other 80%?
So out of the sun.
Right. It's got to come from the sun. And we need to create the kind of investment necessary that is going to transform our economy to create opportunities for millions of Americans, to create pathways out of poverty for at-risk youth, for people in Appalachia that are going to lose their jobs from coal mining, for people in Detroit that are going to lose their jobs or that have been losing their jobs. So this is really an opportunity to transform our economy and create opportunities for our country.
Kenny Ausubel, you seem to me to be just by nature an optimist.
I wouldn't say that. My wife probably wouldn't either, but I'm certainly hopeful. You know, I think there's a difference between hope and optimism. In a way, optimism and pessimism are speculative, and sometimes they're just an orientation of your personality. But hope, I think Vaclav Havel said, is an orientation of the soul, the knowledge that even in the darkest of times, things could be different. And so I would say I'm definitely very hopeful. I also am very fortunate in the sense that my job with Bioneers allows me to be on this star search constantly for all these amazing people doing incredible work, and the work is very real. So, you know, I kind of live in that world, and I think I gain a lot of hope from that.
And it's just about time to go. We'd love to have you back sometime and talk about what Bioneers has been up to lately, because it's an incredible organization that's as you say, has stars that most people haven't heard of doing this incredible work. How do people get involved in Bioneers, and how do they get involved in the One Sky campaign?
Well, people could go to bioneers.org on the web, and there's all kinds of info there. And we have an office here in Santa Fe, too. And One Sky?
Once again, we invite everyone to come down to the training tomorrow, 5 o'clock at the Sub Ballroom at UNM. And you can also go online at oneskynewmexico.org. That's the number one, SKYNewMexico.org. And you can sign up there, and we'll get people plugged in.
John Fogarty is a physician in family medicine and public health, and he is with Physicians for Social Responsibility. The Global Warming Committee is with the New Energy Economy here in New Mexico, and much, much more, the One Sky Campaign. Kenny Ausubel is founder and co-executive director of Bioneers, wonderful organization based right here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Marisha.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with novelist Henry Shookman. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Henry Shookman. He is a novelist and author, poet. He's author of a new book called The Lost City, published by Knopf, and he will be reading a Collected Works bookstore this Friday, the 28th of March, at 5:30. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for welcoming me. Thank you for having me.
It's great to be here. It's great to have you. So let's talk about this book. It's your first novel. It's called The Lost City, and in it we meet a young Englishman fresh out of the army, having lost his closest friend in battle, in war. He goes to Peru to find the ruins of a lost city that his friend has talked about. Wonderful setup. What's the inspiration for the book?
Well, I guess it's partly autobiographical. I mean, very, very, in a small way. In that when I was 19, I went on what we call a gap year in England, after school and before college. I worked in Argentina for a while and then backpacked up the Andes. And in the course of my travels, I went to this area of Peru known as the Cloud Forest, which is sort of on the edge of the Andes towards Amazonia in the north of Peru. And it's an amazingly beautiful part of the world. You know, the clouds are there all the time. It's sort of permanent, strange, eerie place among all these huge trees. And I found, you know, I was already kind of wanting to be a writer and by then. And the place was so you know, evocative and beautiful, that it just never left me. And actually, I started trying to write the book back then, when I was 19. And a little bit of this book was what I wrote then.
Really?
Yeah. It survived.
How interesting. Yeah.
But the sort of feeling to do the book just never left. And years later, I finally did it.
And so, what the feeling was, tell us about the place, because the sense of place in the book is so vivid. Tell us more about the place that really gave you the feeling to want to write about it.
Well, I think in a way to do that, I have to go back earlier to when I was a young teen and began writing poetry. And for me, the poetic impulse was really sort of bound up with landscape. And when I was 13, 14, 15, I used to go and sleep out, as we called it, with a few friends. We'd just take a backpack and sleeping bag, whatever. And we'd go and walk wherever and sleep by a river or canal or whatever we could find
under a tree.
In England, you know. And the sense of sort of, you know, leaving, basically just being outdoors, leaving a house behind, being able to live without a roof, was so exciting. You know, plus, you know, we'd sort of drink beer and do naughty things, you know. But I think the love of an individual free in nature or something like that, which I guess I probably had already kind of inherited from poets like Wordsworth, you know. When I went to this totally different place, Peru, you know, it's just, you know, a million miles from England. It was just a very intense, overwhelming experience to be in such big landscape. And I don't know why, but I just couldn't forget about it and had to do something about it. And it did take me a ridiculously long time to finally get around to doing it. And then I shelved it for years, and then I finally had another push and finished the book a couple of years ago. But I can't really explain, I can't account for it. I can only explain how this love of topography sort of arose. You know, I don't know why, but it just did. I mean, I think it was Plutarch who said that he thought that the most important part of the education of a youth was to spend time in nature. I think there's something in that, you know.
There's also the metaphor in the book of searching for treasure among ruins. So he's looking for this lost city, which has been sort of described to him by his friend who's dead. But it's, of course, I mean, searching for treasure is something that we have going back to time immemorial.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, I think a lot of us, maybe, I hope it's not only me, you know, feel that somehow we have some kind of golden age in our past, you know, some, or maybe it's just a particular psychology that I and various friends of mine seem to share, that a sense that, you know, there was a time when we lived right, you know, we don't know exactly when it was, you know. I mean, it's I suppose it's like a lost Eden, you know, the sense that...
Very much so. I think it's really exactly the biblical Eden that we're looking for. Do you have that in your heart? You really think there was some time like that or some place?
Well, I mean, I do have, you know, when I was 19 and I did this journey, I actually wrote my first book then, which was a kind of travel book, a narrative of my journey. And it was an extraordinarily magical few months. You know, I'd grown up in rainy England, in libraries, reading, studying, and kind of beginning to become a poet. And then suddenly to be so free, you know, earning my own money and then traveling in the backs of trucks with a backpack, and mostly actually in Bolivia, and then some in Peru, but the empty land, you know, and these immemorial life going on among the Indians of that part of the world, it was very magical. It really was. I was with a friend who was a photographer, and we produced our book together, and that too was sort of magical, you know, at that young age to find that we could do that, you know. And then I came home, and, you know, all the sort of realities of life in rainy England with very unhappy parents and my own unhappy childhood that I'd never really reckoned with kind of tumbled down on top of me. So, and I went to university, which I really didn't like. I didn't enjoy. And I was so miserable and depressed that I didn't leave. I just sort of soldiered on and on and on. And so... the contrast between those two phases of my life, both coming at a really early stage, was really strong, you know. And yeah, but I mean, of course, one could.
But then there's romanticizing too, you
well,
know.
Well, I know.
The humble and happy peasant.
Well, absolutely, I know. The you know, it's a kind of Rousseau tradition in the West, you know, the noble savage.
Yeah.
And yet. There is something to it. I mean, I think, actually, I studied some anthropology, and I mean, I think the idea that in Amazonia, you know, there are tribes who live in a more balanced way, in a way that is more harmonious, both among one another and with the world around them. I don't think it is only myth, you know, I really don't. And I think, actually, you could look at 14th, 15th century England and see that it was more harmonious and balanced. Well, it was also, you know, nasty in some ways too. But
yeah, weren't they burning people at the stake?
Well, they did. That was a little later, actually, I think.
Oh, okay.
But they at least when humanity is not destroying its own environment, its own surroundings, its own habitat, I think that must feed into people's state of mind in some way. You know, the post-industrial disaster zone that we all live in is not conducive to peace of mind. We have to strive to find it in other ways.
We're talking to author Henry Shookman. His book is called The Lost City. So the young man, our hero, is at a very vulnerable age. He's 21. He's like a I was thinking he was like a tree that's grown very tall but doesn't really have a lot of bark on him yet. And he goes out, and the first night that he's out, he's robbed and poisoned by an indigenous man, and he ends up with no money and the care of a little Andean boy.
Yeah, at least he has somebody who is, in a way, even more vulnerable than he is to look after. And that's a new experience for him, to have somebody dependent on him. And it's arrived, you know, on his plate so strangely and haphazardly and totally outside any planning he may have had, you know. It's a really unexpected thing that he's got to take care of somebody. He has a lot of growing up to do, you know, and I think I like your analogy a lot, that he has little bark, it's true, but a lot of sort of ambition in a sense in what he wants to achieve. And he necessarily gets put through a lot of ordeals. I think that age is a precarious one for a lot of young men. I think some, you know, deal with that by getting very much on the straight and narrow, you know, doing college, and I'm talking about middle class people now, doing college and a job right away. But others go way off the rails, you know, that's, it's not uncommon. I think it's a very difficult time in a way, because you're trying to figure out how you're going to live, and how you're going to live in a way that feels like it's not a compromise.
And it's also, I mean, there's a wonderful love story as part of this book, and it's also a time in which the openness to that vulnerability in love with another person is just so, so huge.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, the first love, you know, it's. I think for all of us, it's such a big thing. It's something that's really outside the scope of our experience, and we're kind of broken by how huge it is. At least I was.
I think everybody is, and either they're scarred for life or or they move on. But it was interesting because Jackson, the young man, is a British man. He sees Sarah, the American woman, who is a few years older, very much a free spirit, as almost it's a different culture, really. And I suppose British and American cultures are different. I was wondering about your perspective on that,
yeah,
especially in this relationship.
Yeah, well, you know, they say two peoples divided by a common language.
Right.
You know, they are very different. And yet, obviously, we have a lot of history shared. You know, so much of American culture, one way or another, comes from the British Isles. But again, I think he's somebody who's so scarred by, or maybe not yet scarred, more traumatized by the death of his great friend, which he feels responsible for, may have been responsible for, and by the sort of psychological rift that he suffered after that. That for him to find somebody who he can be close to is somehow easier outside his own culture, I think.
We're talking to author Henry Shookman. The book is called The Lost City. He's also an author. I mean, he's also an artist, and a very good artist. Probably it seems like he doesn't even know quite how good he is. Why did you make the character an artist?
Well, I wanted to make it clear that although he had been in the army, which was a sort of strange decision that was kind of more or less forced on him by his father when he was younger, to go straight from school into the army, which isn't quite as implausible as it sounds. I mean, I think here in America it would be a little stranger than it is in England, where, you know, there are kids who go into the army and come straight out and go to college, that sort of thing. He is not only, you know, a tough military type at all, and I needed to show his sensitivity to his surroundings in some way. It was important to me that I didn't just know that myself. I wanted the reader to be able to see that, you know.
So he is in Peru, he's lost his money, and so he has to basically make a deal, which is a quid pro quo. He gets money, and then he has to do something, but he doesn't quite understand what he's getting into, and he gets into a lot of hot water. We don't want to give away the whole book, but that's the source of the tension there. I have often wondered how it is that a novelist like you, a nice Englishman living in nice Santa Fe, knows about thugs and goons and South American killers and drug lords and all of that stuff.
Well, you know, I had my time in the sort of demi-monde of London. And just, you know, in the course of life, one meets people, you know. I've traveled quite a lot, and inevitably that brings one into contact with all kinds of different people, and often people who are unscrupulous, hoping to profit one way or another from the wide-eyed, innocent traveler, you know.
Did you run into problems like that yourself when you were a young man traveling?
No. Never as bad as this, you know. These drug hoodlums and all that, narcotraficantes and all that. Not quite, at least not that I know of. But I've spent time in Colombia for one reason or another, and it's never far away, you know, it's never far away there. It's always just one relationship away, you know.
How do you do your fact-checking for accuracy on things like what kind of guns they use, which you seem to know?
Oh, God. Well, I'm glad I seem to, because I don't really. I do have a friend who's a good journalist, you know, who has done some... he's covered drug wars in Latin America somewhat, and he was helpful. Actually, I also have a good friend who's an archaeologist, a real, genuine explorer-archaeologist guy. He's written a couple of books about Peru, and I sent him the manuscript. And he was very helpful in straightening me out on a few things.
So, one thing I was struck by, and I hope you'll read a little section of it, one thing I was struck by at the beginning of the book was how cinematic it was. You see a perspective from afar, and then you feel like you're in a camera that zooms right in. And I was thinking of the difference in painting after the invention of photography. So there were paintings that started to look like snapshots after photography was invented. And I was thinking novels have sort of done the same thing. They feel more like movies probably than 18th and 19th century novels.
Well, I think there's no doubt that that's true. For one thing, the pace, you know, I mean, the pace of old 19th century books is so much more leisurely. We've got to keep up with the pace of a movie more. I mean, I don't know whether I do that much myself, but, you know, moving in that direction. Somebody said that, I don't know where I read this, but that 70% of our sensory input is visual. But the eyes are the biggest informers of the world around us. I've always felt that I'm kind of drawn to writing that's quite visual. And I like doing it myself. I mean, in another life, I think I'd have been an artist, you know. I like poetry that's, you know, very visual, that's rich in imagery. And I suppose that feeds over into my prose.
The book is called The Lost City, and would you like to read a section of it?
Yeah, okay, sure. Here's a little bit when he first sees the cloud forest itself. From the past, the trail crossed a broad, bare shoulder of mountain, then dropped onto a moorland of short grass. He could see the whole land they were about to enter. He had never seen anything like it. The land was a pile of heaped-up hills. Valleys fanned down to the east. Over all the hills lay a carpet of green, so they looked cloaked like beasts smothered in a green sheet, except here and there where a bare peak rose clear in a litter of grey rock. Above the fissures in the land hung a web of cloud. It was like aeroplane wake in the sky, cake icing puffed out by a baker, an inverse shadow of every watercourse in the land, as if the whole water web of the land had left its breath on the morning air.
Henry Shookman, The Lost City is the name of the book. And he will be reading this Friday, March 28th at 5:30 at Collected Works Bookstore. So you've written poetry, you've written short fiction. This is your first novel, and now we find out that you started it many years ago. But how is it different to write a novel than the other genres that you have been working with?
Yeah, well, in a certain way, I feel if only I'd known it was more different, because I've been in this terrible condition of having five novels and novellas unfinished for something like 15 years. And now I've published this novel, and I've published two of the novellas, and I've got two novels left. And what I've done is treat them, unfortunately, in a way like poems, the things that I just go over and over and over and over and are never satisfied with. Which is, I think poets generally are sort of tinkerers, you know, we like to really rework and rework until we're confident that we've finally got it right.
Yeah, and but you're working with a page or two or three pages instead of 300.
Well, I know, that's why it's taken me so ridiculously long. You know, I wrote three quarters of this book in 98, and I wasn't happy with aspects of it, and worked on it a bit and put it aside, wrote another novel, got most of the way through and wasn't happy with that, you know, and so on. So it took me, and then I'd come back to it and go over it, over what I had, and like it, not like it, you know, and then, which is just what I do with my poems. But it's, yeah, as you say, it's fine if it's a page, you know. But finally, I don't know what happened. I guess because I started to publish more extensively, I started to realize, well, you know, I have Knopf publishing my stories. I have a good publisher in England. Well, likewise, maybe it's time I looked at one of these novels. So this was the one, and I got two left, like I said.
Are you going to actually go back to the other ones and work them into a state where they're publishable?
Oh, yeah, I am. Well, I hope they get publishable. That's what I'm working on at the moment. And I have, you know, I think my publishers are kind of somewhat eagerly hoping that I will deliver before too long.
I mean, one hears about novelists who write their first novel and then put it in the incinerator because it's just, you know, it's getting a lot of the kinks out, but they don't actually use that material.
Oh, I've done that too. I mean, this first novel is really probably more like my seventh.
Uh-huh.
You know, somebody said, this was a publisher, yes, we usually find that the first novel is the 11th. So I'm just a little ahead of the game.
I was talking to a friend not long ago who has written poetry and now is writing a novel, and said it's almost the opposite process. In poetry, you're distilling and condensing, and in a novel, you're taking something and expanding it out over time.
I think that's true. There's a diffuse quality to it that's very hard for a poet to get used to. The messiness, the necessary messiness of creating a novel, is almost unbearable.
And also the necessity of creating plot.
Well, that's the hardest part, actually. I mean, poets can turn quite easily, or quite relatively naturally, to nonfiction. But creating a plot is very hard for a poet. And I think that's probably what I've worked at longest and hardest.
Did the plot come naturally?
Well, some of it did. Some of it did. I mean, I'd write a scene that I just felt compelled to write. Not sure if it even belonged in the book as I conceived it, because it seemed so different, although it was in the same part of the world and involved the same characters. I thought, this must be another novel, as I was writing it. And then I'd realize, oh, no, that's going to be chapter 10, you know. So in a certain way, there is a sense somewhat of uncovering it deep in the unconscious the way the book already knows it wants to be.
So it has a DNA, and you just have to figure out how that's going to open up.
Well, it feels like that. You know, the difference between inventing and discovering, you know, that's an old chestnut. But I think maybe it's hard to tell the difference when we're doing it as the book seems to want to be done. It does feel like a discovery rather than an invention, you know.
Well, Henry Shookman, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. The book is called The Lost City.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Henry Shookman will be reading at Collected Works Bookstore this Friday, the 28th of March. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. And thanks to the people who've been leaving messages, I really appreciate it. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.